going to call this Joint Interim Committee on Justice Systems Revenue to order. It is January the 15th, 2010. And good morning, everyone. We're getting organized here, but you want us to be organized, so we're going to work hard to do that. We have a good agenda, an interesting agenda this morning, and we're going to start off with a revenue report on House Bill 2287, and that will be by Phil. So proceed.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Would you prefer me at the witness table, or may I do it from here? Or?
You know, I would prefer you at the table if that's not inconvenient for you.
I can get there.
It's just a little easier for everybody to focus on you and with question and answers.
There he goes. I'm going to acknowledge this for everybody. Okay. Last Phil goes to the table, Madam Co-Chairs, I wanted to acknowledge a report that we got from Doug Wilson and LFO. He followed up on some questions about the public safety entities from the last meeting, and it was delivered this morning to you, and I just want to acknowledge that for the record this morning.
Thank you, Aaron. All right, Phil, proceed.
Madam Co-Chairs, members, Phil Lemon from the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm here to give you a brief review, an overview of the latest revenue report from the Department of Revenue that discusses how we're doing in collecting the anticipated revenues from House Bill 2287. You have a replacement page in this, and I must do the bar folks, they've received that as well?
They have not received it.
Okay.
We will get it to Mr. Kent and Ms. Graby here shortly.
The difference is that the original document used the legislative revenue final fiscal impact for the left-hand column of numbers that the total is the same, $39.6 million, but there are some differences among the line items that have been corrected in the latest revision. So that's just more background information than anything that affects the bottom line, which is how much money is coming in. As I think many of you know, the end of session revenue estimate for House Bill 2287 was $39.6 million. And this report shows that if current trends continue, actual collections will fall far short of that target. So that's the bad news. We're behind where we should be if we're going to meet that 39.6. We don't have a revised revenue estimate. We can't tell you at this point where we think we're going to end up at the end of the biennium. We've only keep in mind that the vast majority of these fees started to be imposed and collected on October 1, so we've really got about 2 months worth of data, and it's just way too early to be able to tell you where we are, but we wanted to let you know early on that it does not appear we're going to meet the 39.6, and that's just an important thing for especially the legislative members to know, because we're funding important services here. But we will be working with legislative revenue and legislative fiscal staff, and once we get some more experience with the numbers, we'll be able to provide you with a better estimate and, of course, these tracking reports that you'll be getting at every meeting, and if something big happens, then we can let you know between meetings as well. Mm-hmm. So if there is no further growth in the revenue, now keep in mind we're phasing in and kind of on an upward curve. If we didn't grow any more from where we are now, if we just flattened off at current levels, we would get 50% of the collections. So that's kind of the bottom. That's as far down as we think we're going to go. We think there will be more growth in that, and it will come up, but whether how much farther we go up that ladder, we just don't have a real good idea right now.
Okay.
So the table in front of you lists the individual line items, and some of them are collecting above the forecasted amount, a very few number of those. Most are down, some of them are significantly. So let me just kind of walk through a couple of those to point out for you. Crimes and violations, that's about a fourth of the overall revenue anticipated to come in through House Bill 2287, and as you can see, we're substantially down in that, particularly in the felonies and misdemeanor areas. The original language of the bill would have attached the surcharge to sentences imposed on or after the October 1 effective date. The final language of the bill was crimes committed on or after the effective date. And so that added a lag time to get that money starting to flow in. So we think that is the primary reason why we're behind on that. We have the collections fees and court security release deposits. Those are significant revenue areas that are substantially down. We're still looking at the reasons why and don't have a lot of detail to offer you an explanation right now, but we will keep analyzing on that and get it back to you. The court monitoring fee, that is the in essence the bench probation fee when we do not have a community corrections officer supervising, but it's assigned to a judge. That was a new fee. Diversion administration is another one. Expungement is yet another that is underperforming, that's a significant revenue source. The ex parte fee on the civil side is one that is exceeding estimates. And the multiple party civil fee is another major source that is underperforming in terms of estimates. And so that's kind of a very quick run through at a very high level. And again, we will, if you have specific questions, I don't think I'll be able to answer them today, but we'd be glad to look into those and try to get you as much information we can as soon as we can.
I want to give the community an opportunity, however, to answer ask questions.
Absolutely.
And then you can make note of those and for the next meeting. I also want to acknowledge Chris Kent and Susan Grave. Are both of you on the phone, and can you hear well?
Thank you very much. This is Susan Gravy. We can hear well. Chris just now left. He had a meeting at 9:30 that he's chairing, and so he will be back at 11 o'clock.
Okay, great. Well, okay. Thank you, Susan. With that, I'm going to open up any questions that the committee may have on the report about the fees. It's early. Co-Chair Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Some of these things play a lot larger role in the bottom line than others. If I look at misdemeanors and felonies, and you explained why we're not getting that in right now, that's about a fifth of the total for criminal assessment. But I wonder if you or LFO could tell us which of these numbers have the most impact. We can sort of eyeball it, but they're not in order of magnitude. What their contribution to the total is. The reason I'm asking is, for example, we will recoup some of this difference as the basically the rule kicks in. You know, whether the crime was committed or was assessed. So we won't be 93% down by the end of the biennium. That gap will narrow.
Yes.
That gap will narrow. Some of the others, we don't know the degree to which the gap will narrow or will it stay that way. That's what interests me. And depending on how large it is, that will help us understand of the 52% gap we have right now, are we likely to have a 40% gap or a 20% gap by the end of the biennium?
Madam Co-Chairs, that the last question is one I cannot answer yet. And that's why I said we have 2 months of data coming in. We don't really know where in the phasing period or growth curve we are. And so I don't want to scare you too much because we do think that there will be continued growth. And you asked the right question, absolutely, in terms of which we think are frozen and which we think have growth potential. The crime, the felony and misdemeanor, we do think has growth potential, and that will be more of a phase-in issue. We're still early in the curve. The multiple-party civil is another significant revenue source. That will be one of the technical amendments that will be presented to you. That, I think, will help some, but that is one of the other things that we always see. We often see when the legislature passes a law that imposes a financial barrier, if you will, practice changes. And so that's one of the things that we need to, again, get a little more experience with, sort out, see how that's really working and how that's going to shake out. The expungement, is another significant revenue source. That's $2 million. There has been some discussion about, there's a lot of, that is, I think, the courts will be able to tell you best, and perhaps the defense counsel, but that is, that fee, I think at least anecdotally, is proven to be a barrier for people to come in and have that judgment changed. The
any other questions? Frank.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would just like to comment that I think on the side of where there is discretionary decisions about whether to come into court or not, we're seeing some price elasticity of demand in that as we've raised the prices, as Mr. Lemons demonstrated, people are making different decisions about whether they're going to come in and access the court system. And so as we look at these fees, we also sort of need to look and see if we can measure that kind of behavior so we have a true picture of the impact of the fee increases. Access to justice is one of the hallmarks of our state constitution, and in this situation, not just from an economic standpoint, but from a political standpoint, we have changed the rules significantly on access to justice, and I think that's we ought to begin to get some sense of how that change is taking place. It's very early in this process. I think on the criminal collections, because those judgments last for 20 years, we will probably be collecting surcharges on those cases for 20 years simply because of the economic conditions and the ability to collect money from some of these individuals. But that will ramp up and it will increase, and I would support Mr. Lemon's conclusion in that regard. There's a lot of impact flowing out of this fee structure, and I would just want to be sure we try to measure all of it and not just look at the bottom line. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. I'd just like to follow up by a little bit on your comment about access to justice, because I believe that that is a part of the priority that we put on the entire system and on the courts and the kind of attention and respect that we have for the court system in Oregon. And certainly if we're going to minimize anything at all, it should not be including access to justice, but it shouldn't be the system itself as a whole. Are there other questions for Senator Whitsett?
Thank you, Chair Berger. I would just add on my concern that what we appear to be doing here is creating a fee-based court system, and I think that is going to be a deterrent for people accessing their court system. And perhaps this sheet is showing us that early on. The other thing on the multiple party civil filing fees, I struggle with that because because there are multiple parties does not necessarily provide more of an opportunity or more ability to pay. If you have an older person on Social Security that hits somebody in a crosswalk and causes them to be a paraplegic, and there's multiple parties involved, that doesn't provide the ability to pay. I don't follow the logic in charging up to $375 for every party, every plaintiff and every defendant. I struggle with that. I don't see the relationship between the amount of the claim and the ability of the claimant or the defendant to pay.
Mm-hmm. Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsett, briefly, the number of parties is a rough proxy for the complexity of the case. And so that was the basis for looking at that fee. It's not, none of these necessarily are based on ability to pay. It is the workload that is created when those type of cases are filed.
Well, Ms. Lemon, this is a tax. I mean, this was a 60% majority, so it was a tax, and taxes should be progressive, and this certainly isn't.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I wonder if there are some of the same timing issues with some of the civil fees. For example, is the fee for settlement conference for any settlement that takes place after the effective date or for a settlement in a case that was filed after the effective date?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Bonamici, I would wonder if Mr. Bray has a better answer than that. I don't know the answer to that question.
Mr. Bray.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The ex-party fees and the settlement conference fees applied as of October 1, so it's not for actions on or after. I believe just the filing fee for a civil action and not a third-party complaint took effect for cases filed on or after October 1. So, but one of the confusions in this bill, and as it was enacted, and there are a great many, is that there are a multiplicity of effective dates, and it is very difficult for the users to really navigate through all of those. So we do have fees that took effect on October 1. We have cases where there's no change and if the case was filed prior to October 1, and you have to sort of identify the fee, then go back through the bill and try and find the effective date. And it has been confusing for users. It's been confusing for court staff.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Glantz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The one number that leaps out at us here is this 717% increase in the amount in controversy escalator. Can you comment on that just a bit? Or
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Vance. The amount of controversy escalator, that our projection was based on a review of data in OGIN, our case management system, in those cases where the amount in controversy was entered in the system. Not all cases have that entered. So in other words, right, we had a limited data. Our projections were based on that limited data. There are more cases than are reflected in our OGIN system that have an amount of controversy to which that fee would apply.
Follow-up, Manager?
Follow-up.
Thank you. So is this a one-time difference, or will this 700% increase track through the biennium? In other words, can we anticipate that we will have that much more than we anticipated at the end?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Vance, at this point, again, unless things change significantly, I would expect that would continue. But again, we're very early in, and we'll just have to see.
I'd like clarification on which piece of paper we're supposed to be looking at. I don't see corrected dates or revision numbers on the papers. How can we tell the difference between the
members of the committee, co-chairs and members of the committee? The easiest way to tell if you have the most accurate revenue information in front of you is on the first line. It says continuation of current surcharges. That figure should be $1.45 million. Okay. If you have that sheet in front of you, you have the department's most accurate information.
Thank you, John. Well, we had gotten another sheet, and so
and the dates are the same on the bottom.
Yes.
Okay. So I think that was the confusion. Yes, Senator Ritzett.
Thank you, Chair Bridger. Mr. Lehman, on the criminal assessment, the 21 months in the first box there, you mentioned that the misdemeanors and felonies, which are about 25% of that, the reduction is primarily due to the fact that the changing in the language of the bill. Is that also true of the violations? Because they're off 70%.
Excuse me just a moment. Let me look back. Is that the same? Senator Woodson, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Questions are good. This is a complex subject that we're going to be going into, particularly in the spring, when you're trying to decide just exactly the basis upon which a lot of this is going to be funded. Thank you very much. And any information that you can bring.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes,
one
of
more
course.
Question.
Absolutely. Representative Quinn.
Thank you. I guess I'm still confused about this amount and controversy escalator. It shows 10 times what was anticipated. Does that mean we're going to get $5 million instead of $500,000? The current trend would suggest that, if indeed this is not a one-time event.
Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Vance, I don't have a quick off-the-top answer for you there. I'll have to get back to you on that.
Thank you.
And if a change in format would be helpful as we work through these numbers, if again, once we kind of get a better sense of what the trend is for various line items, we can add a column or have some additional information where we have a kind of a net collections at the end of the biennium or something that might help answer some of those questions.
You're talking about projected figures?
Correct.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
All right, committee, we're going to move now into work session. And I will open the work session, and I will welcome Mr. Hendricks to the table. I believe we're going to be talking about technical modifications to House Bill 2287.
Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council's office, and you should have a draft in front of you, LC 100, that shows the changes that have been suggested, put forward for purpose of technical amendments to the bill from last session. This looks like a long bill, but the only things of significance that are happening here are the first seven sections, and so the rest of that is pretty much the things we have to do when we're amending temporary law as far as making conforming amendments to make sure everything ends up where it was supposed to be, even though we are amending these laws for the period that they're going to remain in effect until July 1st of next year. The two most significant things that the bill does is with respect to the offense surcharges, and that's in sections 1 and 2, and then the changes in the filing fees in circuit court for initiating a proceeding, and that's in section 7. The other changes are fairly de minimis adjustments to pick things up that we missed when 2287 was enacted. I can talk about them, but I think probably your time is better spent looking at the three sections I mentioned. The offense surcharges, the change that's being made there, as you can see, is really only one sentence on page 2. The issue here was that when the offense surcharge was first proposed, the concept that was being used and that was reflected in the revenue projections for the offense surcharge was that the $45 for violations would essentially be collected on every ticket that was paid, the full $45. And the problem we ran into was with 153.093, which is a different statute that we didn't amend, didn't look at, that imposed a minimum fine for violations. We're not talking about felonies and misdemeanors here. We're only talking about violations, things in which the only penalty is a fine. Because of the way that statute works, the statute was interpreted basically, I mean, the way that statute works now is that under the minimum fine, the full amount of the unitary assessment is currently collected and paid in out of the minimum fine. Because we did not amend that section or make reference to it, the Judicial Department interpreted the language to say that really we are only probably going to collect 75% of that $45, unlike the unitary assessment, for purposes of depositing in the dedicated account that was set up by 2287. This will correct that so that, in fact, the surcharge will be treated the same way as the unitary assessment. The full amount will be paid out of those minimum fines into the account. If only 75%, the other 25% basically is going into the general fund, instead of being diverted over into this account. So these changes in sections 1 and 2 will have that effect of ensuring that the full amount is, in fact, of that $45 is deposited into the dedicated account. And Section 2 specifically deals with wildlife violations. They are the only violations in the code in which they specify a hard number for the base fine amount for a thing. And the base fine amount, again, is the amount that actually gets written on the ticket that goes out. If you do not increase those base fine amounts by this sum, you will not be collecting adequate amounts to actually generate an additional $45. Once you take out the unitary assessment amount, which is also paid at the same time, you end up, and certain other assessments, you end up with a scenario where there's just not enough money to generate the $45. Unless you do those things, it will not generate the revenue that was contemplated. It would not have the effect that was contemplated at the time it was drafted. And so I can stop there if anybody has questions.
I would like that. Let's stop right there. Does anyone have questions so far about either one of these, the $45 or the modification? Why that has to be? Everybody? Co-Chair Nathanson?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page here, and in some cases literally. In addition to looking at the draft, we also have a helpful handout that has been provided, which describes the technical modifications. And you have just described number one and number two on that chart.
That is correct.
And we're not talking about impact on the people who receive the violations and pay. It's only technically how those things are paid in and out of accounts and how the billing goes through this very complex system. No impact on the final, on the person who is paying.
Co-Chair Nathanson, that's true with respect to Section 1. Section 2 would have an effect on people in that the number will change on the ticket that's issued.
Because of the base.
At the base fine amount. This is an incredibly complicated structure for, you know, the numbers that go on the ticket versus the actual fine. The number that goes on the ticket that people see frequently think that's the fine for the ticket, and that's wrong. That's not the fine amount. The fine amount's determined by other things. For instance, if this is your 10th ticket within the last year, your fine amount's going to be far more than what shows up on the ticket. If it's your first ticket in that year, it's probably going to be less than what shows up on the ticket. So trying to look at it and say, well, by changing that number, it's going to have an impact. It's certainly the amount that they will need to send in if they don't want to show up in court. That changes the amount. Whether or not it changes the fine or not is going to depend more on other issues than what shows up on the ticket. So I hope that's helpful. Again, it's extremely complicated, and I apologize that but if I tried to get into it, I think we'd be here a long time explaining.
But just to just simplify it a little bit, the reason that it has to increase is that you anticipated revenue that would not be the same if you did not modify.
That is correct. That is correct.
Okay. Any questions or comments on this part?
Okay. And then turning to Section 7, the other major change that's being made here. The issue here that's being addressed, and it looks like we're doing a lot more here than we are when you look at Section 7, because there's a lot of bold faith print going on, starting on page 12. The issue that we're addressing here is that as we were going through the process of putting 2287 together, there were various proposals for what sort of things people might want to do. Two of those proposals was, gee, maybe we should charge for multiple parties, again, as was suggested, the reason being that that was kind of a rough measure to try to determine how complex the case was based by how many parties showed up on the complaint. And the other suggestion was that we have a fee amount that changed based on how much was claimed in the complaint. How much was that controversy? You know, is it a lawsuit seeking, you know, $20,000, or is it a lawsuit seeking $2 million? There was going to be a higher charge if it was $2 million than if it was $20,000. The one thing we didn't do well in 2287 was to explain how those two pieces were going to fit together. What was going to happen when you had multiple parties in a big case, or multiple parties in a small number on it? And most of what's going on in here is to try to spell out clearly, okay, here's what's going to happen if you're under those scenarios. And I should tell you that I have been told by the Judicial Department that, in essence, this language reflects the interpretation they have already given to 2287. So in theory, the only way this is going to be generating additional revenues will be hopefully a little bit additional clarity for the clerks out there, et cetera, who have been having difficulties in figuring out, from what I understand, how much the fees should be in some of these cases where you have these two factors coming together, both the size of the case as well as the number of parties. So this is not really a revenue generator. In fact, the only revenue that should be in here is under the offense surcharge. And I can talk about these other little things, but they truly are tweaky things that basically are conforming the language of the sections from 2287 to what people anticipate it want to do, and I'd be happy to do that. Otherwise, I'd be happy to respond to any questions on the Section 7.
Let's go to Section 7 first. Any questions on Section 7? Senator Whitsett?
Mr. Henderson, just following up what I said earlier, I can understand increasing the filing fees for a more complex case with more parties and plaintiffs and defendants and so forth, but I struggle with seeing how that is directly related to the amount of the claim. You could have a very simple claim for a whole lot of money that you're generating a lot of fees off of. That doesn't mean that those, either the plaintiff or the defendant, has the ability to pay.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Berger, Senator Whitsett, I think that's correct. It is a rough way to establish complexity of cases, and there have been some anecdotal stories told to me about some cases that probably were fairly simple, but by their nature involve a large number of people. The one thing I would say is that the Chief Justice does have authority to create exceptions for these, if indeed there are cases where you look at it and say, gee, that's just not right. The one I heard about was lien foreclosures, where you're required to name as a defendant in your complaint everybody who shows up as a party who having an interest in the property that you're trying to do your lien foreclosure on. Well, that's because they all show up in the title report. In essence, you do have a lot more parties, but you may have a small lien, but you're still required by law, if you want to basically secure your rights with the lien, to name all of those parties, and you can end up with a very substantial fee just because of the number of people who show up in the title.
Think of filing an exception to a water right in a district court.
And so, as I said, the Chief Justice does have authority to it, and frankly, for purposes of looking at this sort of thing long-term, you'd want to think through those scenarios and see if some other exemption should be written into the law.
Thank you, Dave.
Other Co-Chairman Nathanson, and then Mr. Bray.
Thank you. Two things. Would you please clarify for us on the chart which numbers you're addressing? I think it's 6, 7, and 8.
Maybe 9.
Does everyone have the chart with them?
So that we can follow along. And the other thing to point out is what we're hearing here are technical modifications to making a temporary surcharge work. In phase two of our committee's work, we'll be talking about this whole structure and how we can simplify it and make it right. These are just technical modifications to make what we have right now work for the next, 18 months or so?
July 2011.
Until we get our other much harder business done, which is to look at all these problems.
Maybe I can go through and just tell you which ones these link up with, so
thank you.
If that would be helpful. One is section one of the bill. Two is section two through four. Item three is section five. Item four is section six, the third party claims. It's also actually items 4 and 5 are resolved in section 6 of the bill. And then 6, 7, and 8 are all section 7 in those subsequent amounts.
Thank you.
There's one thing this draft still needs to do. I wanted to mention this one, as you know, is not going to be introduced as a draft in this session. I drafted this as a 2011 bill. It will come in a different mechanism. So this is really just your language. But there will be at least one additional tweak on it, and that is to address, again, applicability provisions about when these kick in. Some of these, I know that the Judicial Department is concerned that if they had an emergency clause and say, bang, it's going to happen right now, that they would have trouble implementing it, so they're going to want to delay this. I should also say that in 2287, our bill last session, there really was no way to avoid the complexity of the differing applicability provisions. It's the nature of all of these different sections that we're amending and the different procedures that each one had to be looked at separately to determine, well, when's this thing going to kick in? If we had tried to do the multiple party fee retroactively, for instance, that we'd said, well, we don't even cases in the system now, you've got to come back in and pay additional fees. It would have been pretty complicated and not very popular if that had happened rather than cases filed on or after the effective date. With respect to the offense surcharge, we had a constitutional problem in that generally you're not allowed to go back and increase fine amounts, penalty amounts for offenses that occurred before the effective date of the act. And that's what drove that change in the final version to make sure that it only applied to crimes committed on or after, offenses committed on or after. Otherwise, you would have had an ex post facto problem.
Mr. Bray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hendricks, on subsection 1 of the section 7 of the draft, you have recast current RS-21-110 sub 2, which is the under $10,000 exception for civil actions. That exception and special filing fee is historic. It goes back to the consolidation of the district courts with the circuit courts and in the fee schedule. In applying his authority under House Bill 131 or 3199, the Chief Justice created an exception for these small civil cases for the multiple party fee. Has it been discussed whether that exception ought to be just built into the statute, or will that simply continue to be an exception under the Chief Justice's order?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Berger, Mr. Bray. In fact, subsection 1 is the old district court filing fee under $10,000, and you'll know that if you read down to the end of the first sentence, it indicates that the fee is $78 without regard to the number of parties named in the pleading or motion.
All right. I'm sorry, my misreading. Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Thank you very much. You're giving an education to the non-lawyers on the committee.
This is an education to the lawyers, too.
All right. This is an action item on our committee. We're in work session, and I would call on Co-Chair Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. It seems that the questions and discussion are concluded. So, Madam Co-Chair, I move the committee recommend the proposed technical modifications to House Bill 2287 be included in the February 2010 Special Session Joint Committee on Ways and Means Program Change Bill.
Co-Chair Nathanson has moved the committee recommend that the proposed technical modifications to House Bill 2287 be included in the February 2010 Special Session Joint Committee on Ways and Means Program Change Bill. Is there any discussion? If not,
Madam Chair.
Is there...
Madam Chair.
Representative Mintz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, for purposes of the record, want to say that I'll support the motion, but I've received numerous critical remarks about the law in general and about these filing fees. So I know that's not before us today. These are technical corrections, but I don't want my vote in support of this motion to be interpreted as anything other than technical. When it comes to this subject matter, it deserves a great deal of careful consideration.
I think you're absolutely right, Representative Benz, and I appreciate that remark very much. Today, a committee, what we really are just doing is the technical modifications that will, as Co-Chair Nathanson so greatly pointed out, will lay the groundwork, but that doesn't mean that that's not going to change in our further discussions later in the committee. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. All right, now we need John Borden to come forward, I believe. And we're going to talk about the approval of recommended allocation of House Bill 2287 with the revenues.
Good
John,
morning.
Do you mind moving? I think it's just easier for us, and I think maybe the, especially for the Q&A.
Good morning, members of the co-chairs and members of the committee. Before you is a memorandum dated with today's date entitled, or with the subject, HB 2287 distribution recommendations. This memorandum and other items of the committee will be posted to the legislature's website as soon as the committee concludes in the next few days. So that members, interested parties, may have access to them. This, as Representative Nathanson pointed out, is really the short-term task of the committee as prescribed by House Bill 2287. There are three items in this joint staff recommendation that you'll need to consider. The first, what are the public safety system entities that will receive or continue to receive the distribution of House Bill 2287 revenue? What's the methodology for the distribution? And then what amount is to be distributed? Before we get into the actual staff recommendations, I would just offer several qualifications. The recommendations in this memo reflect the possibility, as noted by the Judicial Department earlier in their presentation on revenues, that there's a likelihood not all the revenues will materialize. This recommendation, in light of the likely revenue shortfall, does shift the budgetary risk from the legislature to the Judicial Department and the Public Defense Services. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a few minutes. But in short, if the revenues fail to materialize, the two agencies will be required, where allowed by national and state constitutions, federal and state law, to undertake management actions to remain within available cash resources provided by 2287. In other words, this could reduce operating and staffing levels of the agencies. Joint Ways and Means will be making its final decision based upon the overall general fund budget situation. So with that, I would like to talk a little bit about the legislative track for your committee's recommendations. The committee will recommend and approve actions to Joint Ways and Means, and then Joint Ways and Means will make the final determination, and then that determination will be built into the omnibus budget bill that will go through the February special session. The program change bill that was mentioned earlier, the program change bill is a technical bill for implementation of any budget recommendations coming out. So that's how those two fit together. But there will be a single omnibus budget bill during special session. The public safety system entities in the memorandum that we're recommending receive allocation or further allocation are the Judicial Department for continuation of select court services, Public Defense Services Commission for public defense, Legislative Council for the Oregon Law Commission and Council on Court Procedures pass-through payments, and then in addition, an allocation to Legislative Committee Administration for potential expenses of this committee. The distribution methodology. At your last meeting, we provided a matrix of the options, the various options, and that's attached to your memorandum. What we're recommending is option A, which was a complete distribution, is a slightly modified version of that distribution, which would call for distributing 7 quarters worth of anticipated or estimated revenue and hold 3 quarters back for a potential further distribution once we get into the 2011 regular session. So in other words, this recommendation allocates all but the last 3 months of forecasted revenue for House Bill 2287. It will hold back approximately 13% of the estimated or forecasted revenue, or about $5 million. This conservative approach provides the highest level of budget certainty for agencies during these 7 quarters, yet allows for adjustments if 2287 revenue does not fully materialize. Additionally, in regard to the $150,000 held back for your committee's potential expenses, if those expenses don't materialize, then that $150,000 or whatever remains of it would be distributed to the public safety system entities in our recommendation, or in that the committee concludes in their recommendation. The 2011 regular session, again, will make any final distribution decisions on the remaining revenue that comes in. The staff recommendation, as far as what amounts to allocate, there is a table in the recommendation memo, $15.5 million to the Oregon Judicial Department, $8.9 million to Public Defense Services Commission, $274,022 to Legislative Council for the Law Commission and the Council on Court Procedures. And more specifically, the Law Commission would receive $222,622 and the Council on Court Procedures $51,400 of that total amount. Again, $150,000 for potential committee expenses. All of these entities would also require other funds expenditure limitation, which would again be included in an omnibus budget bill, with the exception of Legislative Council, which already has expenditure limitation for this for their $274,022 expense. The statutory language that will be required related to the distribution would necessitate stating that Legislative Council's allocation, as well as this committee's allocation, would need to occur in a priority order and as soon as possible. The remaining revenue and distributions after Department of Revenue administrative expense, which is very slight, would be based upon 65% of the balance going to the Judicial Department up to a maximum of the $15.5 million recommendation, and 35% of the revenue going to Public Defense Services Commission up to $8.9 million of the recommended amount. This recommendation, this joint staff recommendation, leaves in place the current distribution anticipated in 2287 of the $10 million, which was split 65% Oregon Judicial Department and 35% Public Defense Services Commission. In addition, we would recommend that the committee approve or recommend to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means the following budget note. And the budget note would direct that both Public Defense Services Commission and the Judicial Department essentially report to the Emergency Board Interim Joint Ways and Means Committee during the interim up leading up to the 2011 special regular session, and then during the 2011 regular session, report to the full Ways and Means. And these are the items that we believe that should be reported on: estimated versus actual revenue receipts for 2287, legislative approved other funds, budget expenditures, and applicable positions, actual revenues and applicable positions funded with 2287 revenue, any caseload changes, and most importantly, any management actions taken related to anticipated 2287 revenue changes. In other words, on that last note, we would want to make sure that the legislature, this committee in particular, but also the Emergency Board and Interim Ways and Means, is fully aware that if the cash revenues of 2287 do not materialize, what managerial actions the department, the Judicial Department, and what actions the Public Defense Services Commission is taking to remain within available cash revenue. Because just because an agency has expenditure limitation, that limitation needs to be supported with actual cash revenue. And so if there's a difference there, if revenues fall below the expenditure limitation authorized by the legislature, they will have to manage to that cash balance. So we would just like continued reporting on their actions and activities, on what revenue's coming in, how it's being budgeted versus what was anticipated, and then what actions the department is taking to remain within that available cash. The one final comment I'd make is that we have two separate agencies here. The Judicial Department, which is has predominantly budgeted position expenses, has more managerial flexibility when it comes to their budget than the Public Defense Services Commission, which contracts with public defenders. So in other words, the Public Defense Services Commission has far less management discretion when it comes to their budget than the Judicial Department. And with that, Madam Chair.
John, just a comment on your last one under your budget note. That would be true if the expenditures would need to be increased. In other words, if they come in greater, that very is unlikely. But I just want to be sure that we at least address that. That if they came in and they had more than anticipated.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, yes, that's true. We would get we would see that all the way along, and perhaps as Phil pointed out, there are some of the fees that are overperforming, but if revenues do exceed expectations, the department's ability to undertake management actions would be limited by their expenditure authority. But then that would be taken care of during the 2011 regular session, when they would come back with a request and say, we need to, we have additional revenue available and we would like to make a formal request for that.
Sure. To the full Ways and Means.
To the full Ways and Means, right. Yes.
And Madam Co-Chairs, I did want to point out that there is a need to amend the budget note to say the Judicial Department and the Public Defense Services Commission are requested. We somehow missed the Public Defense Services Commission when we were drafting the budget note.
Okay. Everybody understand that? Okay. Does that complete your report, John?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. I'm going to... I'm going to open it for questions now to the committee. Senator Bonaventure.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you for your report. And I'm sorry, I missed the division between the 274 to Legislative Council. What is the division between the Commission and the Council on Court Procedures, please?
Co-Chairs and Senator Bonaventure, the division is, for the Oregon Law Commission, $222,622. and for the Council on Court Procedures, $51,400.
Thank you.
Is there a follow-up, Senator?
No.
All right. Senator Whitsett?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Borden, it was my understanding originally that House Bill 2287 was to levy $39 million in taxes to on those who access the courts for the benefit of operating the courts. Then we moved further and took 35% of that $39 million and provided it to the PDSC. Then in the last days of the session, we took another $6.5 million from ODJ, just summarily, I assume, and that was the part that the governor line item vetoed and put back in place. So today we're being told that the revenue actually being collected is about 54% less than was anticipated for a number of variety of reasons. Those are the kind of projections that bankrupt businesses and probably bankrupt the court as well. We're further being told that if those revenues don't materialize, it's on the ticket of the Oregon ODJ and PDSC. They're going to have to make up the difference. So it seems to be a sequential defunding of these agencies. The amount to be distributed is now projected to be $24.8 million. That's about 62% of the $39 million. So is the $24.8 million projection a reduction in the $39 million or some kind of proration, or is it reduced by 38% administration fees, or is there another reason why we're not dividing $39 million instead of we're dividing $24.8?
Co-chairs and Senator Whitsett, maybe it would be helpful if I just went through the calculations real quick and let you know that we're remaining consistent with the original revenue projection. But to kind of frame this is, you know, we have very preliminary revenue information. In reality, we have 2 months of revenue information because there's a continuation of the existing surcharge up until October, and then from October until now, when the bulk of the 2287 revenue, the new fees and such came in, that's what we have. So very preliminary revenue information. But what we have as far as the distribution amount goes like this. 39.6% was what was originally anticipated. That was divided about $25.1 million for the Judicial Department and $14.1 million for Public Defense Services Commission, and then the amount for the Law Commission, the $274,000 for the Law Commission. So combined, that again equals the fiscal and the revenue impact for 2287.
Madam Chair and chairs and members of the committee, maybe I could clarify. If you recall, the original bill, $10 million out of that $39 million has already been distributed, with 35% going to PDSC and 65% going to OJD. So the number that you see here is the balance remaining out of that $39 million.
That would be 29.
29.
Not 24.
Well, if I can, if okay. I'll continue through the math because Robin is exactly right. We have the 10 million that was originally and is current law, and again is what we're recommending in our staff recommendation that remain in place. That was part of the initial distribution of this revenue, 6.5 of it to Judicial Department and 3.5 of it to Public Defense Services. Our recommendation then is for 24.6 million of it to go out to these agencies, as well as to to go out to these agencies: Judicial Department 15.5, Public Defense Services 8.9, and then the 274,000. That leaves about 4.7 million left of the total that last quarter. So In brief, we just took the original forecast. It's allocating 7 quarters. 10 of it was already allocated. The remaining 24 would be the recommendation to this committee, and then that leaves a balance of, you know, a little under $5 million for allocation during the 2011 session. And I'm using allocation and distribution interchangeably, but ready for distribution if it materializes.
That gets us to 39.
That gets us to 39.
Thank you for that explanation. Then further, if I may.
Sure. Paula?
Assuming the $24.8 million is all there is to distribute, the distribution formula presented to us provides 62.4% of that reduced figure to the Department of Justice and 35.8% to PDSC. That would be a shortfall of $1.4 million roughly for ODJ, even if you took out the entire $424,000 for the legislative committee and the other parts. You're still shorting the Department of Justice $1 million in that normal 65-35 split by my figures.
Co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, perhaps we could visit about the figures. The intent of this recommendation is to retain the integrity of a 65% allocation to the Judicial Department and a 35% allocation to Public Defense Services.
The numbers don't work.
Perhaps co-chairs and Senator, perhaps we could visit after the committee meeting.
Sure.
And we could compare our figures. Again, our intent with our calculations, we'll gladly double check those, but the basis of our recommendation is to retain that 65-35% split, and the intent of what came out of the 2009 session distribution.
And then one final thing, if I may.
Paula?
On the budget note, you indicated that I believe in your testimony that you're asking both the Judicial Department and PDSC to report, but I don't see anywhere in the budget note where it mentions PDSC.
Co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, my apology. That was an error in the recommendation memo, but Robin had pointed out that we do need to have a pen and ink change on this recommendation to include Public Defense Services, because the intent is for both of those agencies to follow through on these reporting requirements.
Thank you, John.
No, thank you.
John, I wonder, in following up on Senator Whitsitt's figures, that obviously the committee now has heard Senator Whitsitt say, according to his calculations, there's $1 million shortfall with ODJ. So we need to all understand that, and that's great for you to meet after the meeting, but could we also have a memo showing clearly how that $1 million does not compute?
Yes.
So if it doesn't, so
Madam,
we just need
Chair,
clarified.
Could we bring that back? You're going to take final action on this at your February meeting, so if we could double check the figures and make sure when we come back with it to you for your final recommendation, that all of those concerns are addressed.
That's probably a better comfort zone for the committee. Now I'm going to call in Representative Gary.
Oh, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. John, my question is, if I'm understanding what we're looking at, we're basically taking the same approach for both the department and the PDSC, which is to go ahead and allocate almost all of what we think is going to be there in the best case, and then essentially place the risk on them that it may not materialize. But you've also said that those two agencies are a little bit different, in that the department has a lot more ability to make managerial decisions to address the situation, so in the event that there's a shortfall. So I guess what I'm asking is, do we need to be concerned about making this allocation to PDSC if they, compared to the department, lack some of that same ability to adjust down the road if the money does not materialize? is there a risk that they incur some obligations that we don't, that we can't get out of? Does my question make sense?
Yes, co-chairs and Representative Garrett, it is, your question makes perfect sense, and that is PDSC's lack of ability to undertake significant managerial action will mean they basically hit a cliff. You know, their revenue, their cash, available cash is going to fall off, and they may not be able to continue providing public defense or indigent defense. Under that scenario, the commission would not be precluded from returning to the legislature to seek additional funding from perhaps an alternate source. So does that sufficiently answer your question?
I think so. Thank you. Thank you.
Co-Chair Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. As we discuss this, I realize that not only are we dealing with a very complicated system that we're going to be talking about more after it in subsequent meetings, on subsequent agendas, but when I talk with people in the community or work with people who are listening to meetings, I think it can be absolutely baffling that we have a Department of Justice, which I've even heard mentioned today, a judicial department, which is what we are discussing today, and a state justice system revenues, but this isn't involved with the Department of Justice. I think it's it can be bewildering and confusing and at worst misleading. Someone could think we're talking about one department when we're actually dealing with the judicial branch and the court system, and there's nothing we can do about it short of a bunch of statutory changes, probably, to change the name of departments. But I think it's pretty hard to deal with. You know, we have separate things going on in the executive branch and the judicial branch of government with very similar names. And I just struggle sometimes when I'm talking in the community. Well, this time we're talking about this part of the system, and this time we're talking about that, and they both seem to have justice or judicial in the name. It gets pretty confusing for regular folks.
Other comments, Joan? Any other questions? Okay. Now, I have two motions in front of me, and I want to be sure that Robin, you suggested that the final decision be made at the February meeting. That does not deter me from moving forward with either of these motions.
Madam Chair, as I understand it, the staff recommendation to you today is that you direct your staff to draft a memo to Ways and Means for your consideration and approval in February. So the action you are taking today is a direction to staff, not a final committee determination.
I just want to be sure about that.
Madam Chair.
All right, Co-Chair Nathanson. Mm-hmm.
Madam Co-Chair, I move the committee recommend the approval of the four staff recommendations outlined in the LFO memorandum dated January 15, 2010.
Co-Chair Nathanson has moved that the committee recommend the approval of the four staff recommendations outlined in the LFO memorandum dated January 15, 2010. Is there any discussion?
Madam Co-Chair, mm-hmm. I would like to make sure that my motion reflects the addition of the phrase in the budget note, recommendation number four, the Judicial Department and PDSC are requested to report.
So noted. Discussion. Senator Bonamy.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs. I was certainly willing to support the recommendation, the motion to have the staff move forward on this with the understanding that we will be having further discussions. I think there have been some very important issues raised today about access to justice and allocation of funds and the flexibility of the recipients of these funds to manage any unanticipated shortfall. So I'm happy to support the recommendation today with that understanding that we will be having further discussions as we go forward.
Good comments.
Thank you.
Is there any objection? If not, the motion passes. Co-Chair Nathanson.
Madam Co-Chair, I move that committee staff be instructed to draft a memorandum to the 75th Legislative Assembly and the Joint Committee on Ways and Means from this committee recommending distribution of the revenue and establishing necessary other funds expenditure limitation language for final consideration at the committee's February 2010 meeting.
Co-Chair Nathanson has moved the committee staff be instructed to draft a memorandum to the 75th Legislative Assembly and the Joint Committee on Ways and Means from this committee recommending distribution of the revenue and establishing necessary other funds expenditure limitation language for final consideration at the committee's February 2010 meeting. Discussion.
Madam Co-Chair, same comment as before.
Same comments. Thank you. That's very good to point out. Any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. Well, committee, good work today, staff, presentations. I think that we have a lot ahead of us to discuss in the revenue that will be coming in and the distribution of it and how that's going to handle, and it's going to be a very interesting time. Panel, we have set aside a good time now for some discussion of a potential contract with the National Center for State Courts for a study of the Oregon State Justice System revenues and funding structure. So, Robin, if you'll come forward and present this to us.
Madam Co-Chairs and members of the committee, we've had quite a bit of a discussion this morning about the complexity of the statutes and the fee structures and a little bit of a discussion about the charge that this committee has after February. When your staff was preparing for the work of this committee, we met to talk about how we would assist the committee in obtaining the information that was necessary to help them do their work. And one of the things that we were curious about and thought would be helpful would be to get an idea from other states about how their courts are funded, what kind of fee structures they have, what kind of collection methods they have and how successful they are, and a number of other issues related to that. And we had several discussions with the Judicial Department about what information they could bring to bear that would be helpful to the committee. And what the department recommended was that there is a resource out there called the National Center for State Courts, who do these kinds of studies and have done quite a bit of work for the Judicial Department in a number of different areas. So based on that discussion, we had several conference calls with the National Center for State Courts, and the result of that was a proposal from the National Center for State Courts for a study of comparable justice systems around the nation, a study of revenue and fee structures and related kinds of things. And so what I wanted to talk to you about today was whether or not the committee would be interested in entering into a contract with the National Center for State Courts for that study. And one of the things attached to my memorandum to you was a list of questions that would form the basis for determining whether or not deliverables had been met. And I kind of wanted to go through a few of those. For example, the initial responsibility of would be to determine if there are states in the nation that have a similar kind of funding structure for the judicial system, and by that I mean whether or not there is a unified court system. And believe me, there's wide variety around the nation in how courts are structured, how they're funded. So that would be the initial pool, as it were, of for the research. And then we would be asking for information on the total revenues collected, the revenues that are retained by those judicial systems, versus revenues that are transferred to the state general fund or other distributions. The types of fees, fines, costs that are collected, again, that's going to vary by state. The mix of general fund and fee revenue that supports the courts, again, in some states, we believe there's a heavier reliance on fees, and if that's the case, we would like to know how that works. In others, I believe there's a heavier reliance, as in Oregon, on the general fund to support the judicial system. And then we were looking to find out if there had been any studies and revisions undertaken by these courts that would help this committee when they are looking at the kinds of things that need to be done to simplify the court fee structure here and to preserve access to justice. So those were sort of the broad parameters of what we were looking for from a study. And then we entered into discussion with the National Center for State Courts and came up with a draft contract. We worked with counsel. The cost of the study would not exceed $100,000. The payment would be out of the fees generated by 2287. There would be monthly status reports to staff and the committee. That NCSC would appear before the committee at the meeting closest to April to present a draft report, and at that time give the committee a chance to weigh in on the structure of the final report, on the information that was being collected, and make any other kind of course changes that needed to happen. And then and we contemplated payment half at the successful presentation of the preliminary report and half at the presentation of a successful final report, again, totally subject to this committee's approval. And then a final report to the committee at the meeting closest to September 2010. I wanted to present this option for the committee's discussion and determine if this would be helpful to the committee's charter and meeting its goals under 2287.
Okay, I hope all of you have had a chance to take a look and think a little bit about whether you like the proposal to have a study by the National Center for State Courts, or whether you don't, what you think about the funding for this, et cetera, et cetera. So let's have some good discussion. This is a pretty serious subject, I think, for the staff. And so there will not be any action taken today. It's strictly to give you an opportunity to express to the committee some of your thoughts about how we are going to simplify. I guess, Robin, I have several concerns. My first one is that we're comparing apples and apples and not apples and oranges. So you mentioned the unified court system. On the states that are listed in their proposal, are all of those unified court systems, are they one of the 26 court systems in the United States that have the same that we do?
Madam Chair, let me take a quick look at what they have proposed.
Otherwise, they're giving us information that is not as helpful. I couldn't tell, but perhaps you can
quite
tell.
Quite frankly, I can't tell. That would be a question that we would need to ask. I believe, and John, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that that these were selected because they were unified court systems. But as you can tell, even within that definition, there are very different structures in terms of how these courts are organized. I noted that some...
Alabama, for instance, is a two-tier court system. I don't know what that means.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, on page 3 of the proposal, at the bottom of the page, there's a comment, a sentence that reads, the recommended criteria for selection are budgetary unification.
And it does not include county justice and municipal courts.
And Madam Chair, for the purposes of this, this committee's action, neither does Oregon. And in Oregon also has some anomalies, in particular west of or east of the Cascades, where some counties still maintain their own juvenile and probate courts and are not part of the state unified court system.
Right.
So I don't know that you're going to have, I don't know that you're going to find any state that is exactly like Oregon or any state that is exactly like another state. But we were looking for states where the bulk of court functions are funded by the state.
Well, and unified doesn't mean standardized, because we have every kind of formula throughout the 36 counties for how they operate with their court system. So, which isn't all that desirable for this committee that is looking at the system where you have so many different systems. Well, I'm going to start to my left, Senator Bonamici. And any comments that you might have, and I'm just going to go right through the committee.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm intrigued by this, and I was relieved that you said we weren't going to be making a decision today, because I think that, you know, in good times, spending this amount of money on a study would be easy to do, but these aren't good times, and it's a more challenging decision. I want to follow up on your comment about comparing apples and apples, Madam Co-Chair, because I noticed that here on page 2 of this proposal, it talks about the key consideration being a selection of comparable states. And this sentence leapt out at me. Other aspects will be more difficult to obtain, particularly the analysis of state revenue structures, which tend to be complex and are rarely subjected to any rational analysis. So I'm concerned that we are looking at comparable states in many ways, and I think that's going to take quite a while to find something that's comparable to Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of our revenue structure with all the things that we need to fund that have been implemented by initiatives, for example, and our two-legged revenue structure. So I think it will be an interesting thing to look at, and I look forward to more discussion. I certainly would think that the information would be useful, assuming that we get everything that it looks like they're after here in this proposal. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I think this is also, I'm intrigued by this, and I had actually had the same sentence highlighted, Senator Bonavici. Go back to the attachments. I think it'd be very interesting and very worthwhile for the committee to put together a Oregon box, the estimated population, the scope of state funding, budget in millions, FTE, and so forth, so we can get an idea of compare the cost of Oregon per capita, the cost of Oregon per FTE, the cost of the judicial system per FTE and the judicial system, and so forth. So I think that'd be a very helpful thing to do.
That's possible, right?
Oh, yes, Madam Chair. I was nodding and making a note, so I think that's certainly something we can add to the deliverable, certainly.
Okay. Other comments, Senator? All right, Co-Chair Nason, I'm going to skip over you and have you last. Okay, Representative Bent.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess I'd be curious in just asking you your opinion if this is the most efficient way of accomplishing what we're trying to do. I'm not sure that I'm convinced. But before I talk about it, why don't you tell us what you're thinking?
Madam Co-Chairs and Representative Benz, what led to this was a recognition that neither your staff nor the Judicial Department have the resources to be able to undertake this kind of analysis. And we felt that this was information that would be very helpful to the committee. So I think my answer to your question is yes, I think this is, it is at least the only option we identified to be able to gather this kind of information.
Follow up. When you say the only option to gather the information, that I am interested in what other means of achieving this goal were considered. For example, hiring someone who has had experience in going to some other state and doing a similar project, or somebody, some expert out there that could come in and do this job as opposed to this organization. I just want to know what the universe of options was that were considered.
Madam Co-Chairs and Representative Benz, we considered whether or not we wanted to do an RFP process. In the scope of studies, this is considered very small. The cost of an RFP process, the kind of workload it would add to this staff in terms of selecting setting the criteria and selecting the vendor and that kind of thing, we just did not think it was cost effective to take that route. Those of us who've done it before know it's a very labor intensive process to go through that kind of selection. We also looked at the kind of workload that would be involved in terms of any of us trying to do this. And then the final thing I would say is this wasn't just an arbitrary decision. The National Center for State Courts does this kind of thing. They have done a variety of, and Doug can speak to this, a variety of studies for the Judicial Department, for example, on a wide variety of court-related things. So they have the expertise to be able to do it. So those were the considerations that we had when we were pursuing this.
All right, Bob. The remark about the small amount of money, that's the $100,000, is rings really true to me. And the size of the problem compared to the amount of the money, it's really wishful thinking. If you ask me, to suggest that kind of money is going to get this job done. Do you think that when we get done, we'll actually have something that won't just find its way quickly into a corner? Will it be ignored? Or is this something that, because of the steps that are suggested, we actually would see a result, in your opinion?
Madam Co-Chairs and Representative Benz, we wouldn't bring this proposal forward if we hadn't thought through what the product would be and whether or not it would be information that would be valuable to the committee. From my perspective, the report itself is, its intent is to inform this committee and help the committee with its decision making. So the report is, it is not a standalone item of value to me beyond what it helps inform the committee of in terms of what you need to do in looking at, you know, what's in the charter. How do you ensure access to justice while ensuring a revenue system that is fair, that is collectible, that is easy to administer? How do you ensure adequate funding? And I don't know what adequate means, but adequate funding for the judicial branch of government. I mean, those kinds of questions, we hope that this study would provide information to help you determine. And then the other part of it is that's the whole intent of requiring an appearance midpoint so that if it doesn't look like what's being produced is useful, you will have a point for a midpoint correction.
And just a few remarks.
Continue your discussion and any comments. Okay. Don't limit yourself to time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my thought is I shouldn't have said it quite the way that I did. I apologize for that. Maybe what I should have said is that I fear that this would be a very good start, but we wouldn't have allocated the time or the resources to finish the job. That's probably the better way of putting it. And so my final question is, for the moment, are the other players, shall we say, the counties, the folks in these systems, have they been asked to suggest solutions to the current hodgepodge of problems we've got? Is this the first run we've taken at this, or is this one of a number of different failed attempts? Incomplete attempts.
Madam Co-Chairs and Representative Vance, first of all, the task in front of you is to deal with what the legislature has enacted in terms of statutory fees. So it is your problem to solve. That said, there is a wide range of interaction between the judicial department and the fees that are collected on behalf of counties and other kinds of anomalies that where the counties are a part of how the fee structure is established. The answer to your question is no. No one has undertaken that approach yet because, from my perspective, there really isn't much of anything to take to the counties at this point in time. And then the other part of it is that there is a very, there are a couple of efforts underway that I'm aware of, one of which is chaired by Representative Nathanson, to start looking very seriously at how state and local government interact and to try to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of those systems. And I would hope that whatever this committee does ties into that effort.
Well, colleagues, I think my thinking on this is that this is an effort that absolutely positively needs to happen. And I'm just fear that I don't really want to start down the road without adequately funding it and understand because it's a bunch of work that needs to be done, and I just fear that this is not as much as probably maybe we should be doing. Now, if our experts think that this is a necessary element of any action, then that's fine, and we could build on it, and something we could build on later as we get to it, but it would be unsatisfactory to get started without making sure we know we can bring it to an end. It's a huge amount of work, and I just fear that this very small bite may not be followed up with the rest of the job.
So let me be sure that I understand what you're saying, and that is that the fact that we would say that the adequately funding level is such and such, but we would never be able to get to that level even after we had determined it. Is that
right? Maybe what I'm saying is this is a piece of work that needs to be done. I think it's much larger than $100,000. I think there's a commitment, if we're going to do it right, that needs to be made, and I don't think $100,000 is adequate. That's what I'm saying. This is a big job. And I would just want to say that if we're going to start down this road, we should be doing it with the intent to finish it correctly. And now, if we're hearing that this can be done for $100,000, we'll actually get it, then that's fine. But my experience with this is that this is a complex matter, and $100,000, geez. So I'm not saying not to do it. If our experts say this is a necessary step and we can build on it in the future when times get better, so be it. But just don't want to take a half a step and not take it the rest of the way.
Okay, could I ask you one other question? if you feel that way, and so is it the fact that this is limited to what other states are doing and doesn't include a wide enough scope that might not be enough? Or is it that you just don't believe that the $100,000 study would do it, even limited to the study of the other states?
Actually, Madam Chair, my thinking is that the focus should really be on Oregon's system. My experience in looking at other states is, to go back to your apples and oranges thought, that's what I think is going to happen. And finding a magic answer in another state is highly unlikely. What really is going to end up happening is we'll see some good ideas, and then the real work of trying to fight our way through all these difficulties with the counties and other organizations will start. That's what I think is missing.
Okay. All right. I understand you now.
Okay.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This has been a really good discussion, and I think I have a comment that's kind of similar to Representative Bent's. I'm attracted to the idea of doing the study. I think we always can benefit from looking to other states for what works and what doesn't. But in listening to the discussion, I actually have a concern that we not overly limit the scope of the study, because while it's important to do the apples-to-apples comparison, I also think one of the benefits that can come out of our work is to identify and possibly propose more bold changes to how we structure our system in the state. And if there are best cases out there in the country of state systems that work very well, I'd like to know what they are, even if they may have some major differences with how we currently do things in Oregon, because that could be food for thought for us about, I don't want to take our current structure as given. I think this is actually an opportunity to reconsider some of the ways we do things. And so perhaps a really valuable study would do both. It would tell us, with your existing structural limitations, here's how you can make some improvements. But also, if you wanted to be more visionary and make some more far-reaching changes, here are some other examples of how states have done this.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Mr. Bray.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. First of all, I think I need to disclose to all of you that as a staff person in the Office of the State Court Administrator for about 15 years and a Deputy State Court Administrator, now as the Trial Court Administrator in Multnomah County, I have worked since its creation with the National Center for State Courts on a number of projects. They are, in this nation, the single best source for this kind of overview and work, and they do this on a regular basis for states, state court systems, and states, and provide these services. They have in place a staff that can easily gain access at least to court-related information across the breadth of the states, because most states are supporting members of the National Center. So in that reason, they have access and they have experience in this area, and I think that goes a long way to recommend them for this work. We're in a special time right now, however. You'll recall just before our November meeting, the Pew Center for the States came out with a report that listed all of the states that are about to topple off the edge, and Oregon was the poster child in that release as the state that might next end up in the same situation that the state of California is in because of our general overall state taxing structure. Also in November, Chief Justice Margaret Marshall from the state of Massachusetts gave a speech to the New York City Bar. The topic of her speech was at the tipping point, state courts and the balance of power. And I have spoken to staff, and I will send a copy of those remarks to the committee. But in this discussion, Chief Justice Marshall raises that state court systems are in real jeopardy in this country, because in just about every state, they are going through these discussions about how do you finance and fund an adequate third branch of government so that you can maintain the rule of law and maintain access to justice. It's a question in every state system. I was just with some National Center for State Court staff people from their Denver office who are working with my court on how we downsize and how we change all of our business practices to learn to live on less resources. They're doing these studies all over the country, so they have a structure in place to, I think, readily give us some valuable information. But what we can expect from this isn't going to be a blueprint, as Representative Benz has said. They're not going to walk in and say, here is the magic solution. What they're going to do is they're going to come in and they're going to tell us what's working or not working in lots of places. But right now, the common experience across the country in state court systems is that just about everything is not working. So these are incredible times that we're in right now. Having their assistance in this study, however, gives us the best possible chance to have access to information as it develops across all the states so that we can evaluate it and have some benefit of it. However, I agree with Representative Benz very much that there's still a lot of heavy lifting to do to solve this problem. The issue of our state court financing system that's in place now and what happens with the revenue that the state court systems acquire has never been fully vetted and evaluated because it has grown as incrementally with additions to it, with new assessments, new fees, new dedications, new distributions in all of my history here, and I'm sure that it has been that way for a long time. So every entity that is receiving those revenues is vitally concerned that revenue stream not cease. And that makes reform of this system incredibly difficult. And it's hard work, and it's going to be hard work, but it should be done. All of the players in the system have a real interest in this, and none have a greater interest, I think, than the civil bar who practice before our courts, but also just all of the people of the state of Oregon. And this is a study we need to undertake. I think that as states wrestle with this, and a lot of states are looking at what Oregon did in its 2009 session, as states wrestle with this, during their annual sessions, which are going on now and starting, there will be probably in most of them, if not all of them, these kinds of discussions going on. So having the ability to tap into that easily and get some source of what's going on there, having reports back as those sessions wind down and they put into place solutions, are all reasons to go forward with this. It is $100,000, but I think it would be $100,000 well invested for us. But I want to be clear, it won't give us a blueprint. It will give us a basis to make better decisions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bray, for those excellent, excellent comments. I wonder if you feel that a study with a different scope, still at the National Center, since you have worked with them, rather than a comparison of what other states are doing, but perhaps just simply a study of what they have found and what are they learning about the courts generally throughout the United States. We're all in trouble. So and you said they were looking at that and trying to figure out what would be the best thing to help that situation. Perhaps a study that with a different scope would be better and we might learn more?
Madam Co-Chair, I think that the scope and the deliverables that Ms. Lamont have laid out are very good for our purposes here. Now, in a sense, the answer is we need everything that Ms. Lamont identified, and that's really going to help us to really know what more we might need. But I'm not sure we can guess right now what we drop off and what we put on. As a can be can be made intelligently, except maybe with more discussions with staff people from the National Center for State Courts. I am happy with the list of deliverables that Ms. Lamont's developed.
Mr. Kent and Susan and Chris, are you still on the line? Hello? Chris? Susan?
Well, he was going to be chairing a meeting until 11. He might just be a couple minutes late coming back.
All right. Well,
we'll try again.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Indeed, this is going to require a lot of heavy lifting. Whether something would come out of this study, well, something has to. It's our responsibility to make recommendations and draft legislation to improve the existing, to make improvements to the existing revenue structure. It's what we're obligated to do. We've got a report to the next legislative assembly. I was just reviewing some of the phrases in the language of House Bill 2287. Simplification, minimization of administrative and public costs, transparency, judicial system access. Another phrase concerns me, and it's going to lead into reacting to this proposed study. Where practical, aligning justice system access and costs with the revenues collected. Because of the nature of our court system, and Oregon isn't unique in that apparently every state has quirks about how it's arranged its court system, we aren't necessarily dealing with the whole justice system because we've got a system of state courts, but we also have municipal courts. There's justice courts out there that are outside our purview. Why? I don't know. I need some background on how did we get here. You know, there have been district courts, circuit courts, justice courts. How come we have this arrangement? What's the deal? And if we're trying to ensure appropriate access for all Oregonians, but we can only talk about part of the system, we're not doing as good a job as we should be, I think. So then that leads to, what would we get from the study? And when I look at the scope and potentially selecting certain states as being the best for comparables, I have two reactions. One is, we might miss some good ideas. There may be a couple of states that would be excluded from study right off the bat because they don't qualify as a comparable, but maybe there's really a very interesting, useful system there that could be proposed. Or if not system, certain aspects of here's how something gets billed or here's how it gets reported.
Could I interrupt just for a moment, Madam Co-Chair? One of the deliverables, and I didn't read it, but one of the deliverables is a request that the National Center identify best practices outside of the scope of the courts that are selected because they look the most like Oregon in terms of how the courts are funded. So I would hope that concern of yours is addressed.
Okay. But beyond that, I hope that we are able to get some good food for thought reacting to some of the comments around that I've heard around the table this morning. I think we need to be looking at more just the mechanics of billing. We've got a really complicated system of how we assess fees. And when you look at that fee table, there's not a fee table for the state. You have to then look at tables for each one of 36 separate counties to figure out how things work. So we could come up with something that might be, the mechanics might be simplified in the way things are assessed or billed, but we
didn't do a good enough job of really addressing the structure of the system. And I hope we can get to that discussion. In the other task force that Ms. Lamont referred to on government efficiency, dealing with those programs or services where both the state and counties have responsibility, there's a saying that has been expressed that I thought was compelling. Well, you see one county, you've seen one county. It's very complicated. Is there a way to work with counties? There was a statement made a few minutes ago that we don't have anything to show counties yet. The purpose of my task force, and I would hope what we could do, is we don't come up with something and then show it to counties and say, what do you think? Can you get on board? Because this is what we want to do. But rather, start with the counties and say, we both are facing a problem. How do we solve this together? So I would hope that we're working with them initially in developing, recognizing problems and developing solutions, rather than taking an approach of, okay, we've been working for 7 months, figured something out, and now can we sell it to you? I do think we need information. But I think I'm glad that the co-chair has mentioned that we're not making a decision today, because it's a large amount of money to spend. If we're going to spend that amount of money, we need to be sure we're spending it right and that the deliverables are what we need to go forward and then have solutions.
What a thoughtful committee. How lucky we are. If anybody can meet the challenge, I think we have the right people here to do it. I think that there are several things that come into play in Oregon that may not come into play in other states, and even if we did the study, we can certainly consider that at the time. But local control is a big thing in Oregon. And so that's one of the reasons that we have at the local levels, whether it's cities or counties, that they've been allowed to do things that they feel tailor their systems, whatever that system is, to the people that are in that area. And Oregon is different than other states. And I think that they can take a lot of pride in that. I worry a little bit about us being too influenced by what other people do rather than being our own individual state and doing the things, because we're creative and innovative. We've done a lot of things that other states haven't. And if you've attended, I'm sure all of you have, some national committees, and people look at your name tag and see you're from Oregon, they immediately want to have a conversation with you on how you're dealing with whatever it is, whether it's healthcare or senior and disability issues or transportation issues. But Oregon catches the attention. And I think that I have to agree with Senator Bonamici that $100,000 on a study, in good times, we probably wouldn't even have that in the basic criteria of deciding. But in these times, $100,000 is a lot of money. And that goes to the question of, if we spend this, are we going to get our money's worth? And I think that that is extremely important, that we look at whatever agreement we have with the National Senate, that it is exactly what we feel we're going to need, and that that information is going to be useful. I do share some of the comments of Representative Benz, and that is I really want us to look at the Oregon system. I would like for us to just be able collectively to figure this out and to have some real innovative magic ideas of our own, where other states would be saying, I tell you what, to the National Center, would you please send us a blueprint of Oregon, because they got it figured out. But along the way, we have a staff that is not going to be able to commit to the kind of time that we would need in gaining information. So this is one of the ways that we can do that, and that we can do it. But I think we have some concerns here to consider, and that was one reason I did not want this to be anything but an informational meeting, that you have a chance to think about this and consider it, and what other options. Representative Ben said, are there experts that do this that can come here and tell us, and do we have any other options? And so I have taken some of those comments to heart. Are there any other comments that anyone would like to make? Mr. Kent, are you on, Chris?
I am, Senator.
Oh, good.
I caught the tail end of the discussion.
Well, good. Well, I wish that you had heard all of it, but that's perfectly all right. So give us your comments about how you feel about the proposal that we get this study.
My first reaction, and I want to listen and review the materials again, but when I went over it and hearing some of the comments, my first reaction from the bar's point of view is I do think there's a need for study. This is a complicated issue on the fee side. It's complicated on the allocation and the administrative side. There are certain apparent inequities on both ends of that scale. It resonates with me, Senator, your comment that we shouldn't just follow along with what everybody else says, or Representative Nathanson's comment about, well, gee, maybe we're going to be missing out if we don't select certain states. But I think overall, getting that information, I found the overview presentation very enlightening. I don't have to have the responsibility of spending the money like you folks do, but I do think that we should spend the money and do it. I think it'd be worthwhile, and I think it may really assist us ultimately in getting the best product.
All right. Thank you very much. Is Susan still there?
She is not.
All right. All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm so glad that you were able to get back before the discussion was totally over, so we could get your feedback as well. Committee, I would like for the members of the committee to give this some thought, and if possible, to let Co-Chair Nathanson and I know what you feel would be worth the funding, and it's up to $100,000, not necessarily $100,000, but what you feel you would want to get at back if you decide to spend that kind of money. Because I think that we need to get on the same page as to what we really expect, so that after it's said and done, we're not saying to the staff, well, I thought we were going to get such and such, and now I've agreed to spend the money, and look what we've gotten, and it's not helpful. And so I think for the protection of our staff who will be moving forward, and for our own information, we each need to give that information as to, if you agree that we should have the study, what do you expect? What do you anticipate that you will get back for the study? But I think that there is a strong leaning on the committee, if I've heard everybody correctly, that we need more information, that this might be a good way of getting some good information that we have, et cetera, et cetera. So, Senator Whitsitt, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to ask a quick question. Can you give me, just round figures, rough figures, the total amount of fees and assessments that are collected annually?
Excuse me, are you asking in the judicial department?
Yes.
And maybe the co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, the department maybe can help with that, but in real round figures, I believe the revenue that flows into the general fund is right around $272 million or so budgeted right now, and it'll probably be less than that given the economic environment. Phil, is that consistent with One of the handouts, the prior handouts that you should have in your notebook, and it is posted on the website, is entitled Projected Court Revenues for the 2009-11 Biennium. And they, it's based upon a September 2009 forecast and shows $278.4 million across a whole, based upon fines, forfeitures, assessments, filing fees, and indigent defense, and other revenue sources. So again, the $278 million.
Thank you. We had a conversation with an accounting person from the Department of Justice in one of our previous meetings. I can't remember her name right now, and I promised her I wouldn't hold her to her estimate. But she suggested that the accounting fees, the accounting process could cost as much as 30% of the that whole thing.
Yes.
That is a lot of money. And if we were to be able to focus a study on how to reduce that to a more reasonable 8%, I think we would find a whole lot of money on the table. And so that's just my thought in closing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any other closing? Yeah. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. One of the disadvantages of going first is that a lot of thoughts have been provoked in the discussion. I'm very much persuaded by Mr. Bray's recommendation of the organization, someone who has experience working with them. But I do note that he was talking about how the report will be information but not a solution. And gosh, I want a solution. But one of the things that I'm thinking of through this discussion is the analogous, I believe, in some ways, Quality Education Commission, which studies the education system and says, this is in order to, here's where you need to get, here's how much you need to get there, but then doesn't answer the question of how do you get there. So I'm certainly not interested in spending money for a report to come back and say you need more money, because I think we can all answer that right now. So I really am looking for mm-hmm. solutions as well. And you know, Representative Garrett talked about structural solutions, and I think we need to be really open-minded on those things. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
I think that's why the committee, it's very important to the staff that the committee show what they anticipate from the study. Other closing comments?
Madam Chair, could I request a sort of procedural way to address the committee feedback? I'm wondering if we could ask folks to get any changes to the deliverables or any recommended changes to the scope or any changes that the committee recommends, if they could get those to Aaron, and then what your staff can do before the February meeting is to compile the recommendations and bring that forward as either a recommendation to the committee or sure. some options for the committee to consider.
Sure, that's fine. And I will use the same procedure if there are things that you want from the study to include that, then that would just be fine. All right. If there's no other business to come before the body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.